Nur sehr kurz. Es wäre super, wenn wir heute wirklich pünktlich.
Ja, darum will ich anfangen.
Das ist so, dass du das ein bisschen managst, weil wenn nicht, dann haben wir Probleme mit den Russen, mit den Guides, mit Wines und mit allem.
Ja.
Also heute ist es sehr wichtig, dass
wir darum will ich nicht anfangen.
Das sind, okay, danke.
Ich weiß. Okay, good morning. Happy to have you all here just in time at 10 o'clock. Welcome back to the EUFORA's Interparliamentary Meeting. I think that everybody of you had been here yesterday already. I mean, probably Mr. Mansoneto was not here yet yesterday, but all the others, I hope, were here. So welcome to the second renewable energy session this morning, and we will discuss today a little bit how we roll out renewables, how to make sure that this becomes a success story, and how this is also linked into infrastructure questions. And to go straight into the topic, I would like to invite Mathieu Fichter. He's from the DG Regional Policy, so they make sure that also we develop that stuff in all the regions. And he will tell us how the regional structure and other funds can help to develop renewables and efficiency and to make sure that the funding is there. So you will hear great stuff. Mathieu, welcome.
Yes. Good morning, everybody. And first, I would really like to thank EUFORES for the invitation and for giving us the opportunity to speak here at this extremely interesting meeting and to present to you a bit more this very important policy, which is cohesion policy. Really, thanks a lot. It's an honor for me today to speak here. And I'm already really excited as well to look forward to the roundtable we are going to have at the end of the day, where we can dig a bit more into the details of what I will going to present now in the next 15-20 minutes. Before jumping into the subject, cohesion policy and energy, I want to give a quick overview of what this policy is. It's quite complex, and probably you don't know all the bits on this policy, so I will just give you the key features because it's important to know how this policy actually works. Extremely important, it's highlighted there, the aim of this policy, what is written in the treaty, it's about social, economic, and territorial cohesion. So it is not a thematic policy, for instance, whose aim is to foster, for instance, implementation of energy projects only. It's, of course, aligned with Europe 2020, creating jobs and fostering growth. And it is three funds. You might have heard about these funds. So it's the European Regional Development Fund, the Cohesion Fund, and the European Social Fund. My intervention will be really focused on ERDF, Regional Development Fund, and the Cohesion Fund. You can see it's really a lot of money. So the responsibility is huge. But this is the second biggest part of the EU budget, 350 billion euro in the next 7 years. The map is interesting because it shows that we have three categories of regions, the so-called less developed ones in red, where the bulk of the funding goes, the transition regions, having between 75 and 90% of the EU average GDP, and then in light yellow, the more developed ones, which have a GDP above 90% of the EU average GDP, where there is obviously much less funding. How does it work? Where do we stand? There are strategic documents negotiated between the Commission and the Member States. They are called partnership agreements, which are now being finalized. About 20 out of the 28 partnership agreements are already agreed, and then the other ones will be agreed by end of October or November latest on. And then we have operational programs where really you have the details on what the funding is going to be used on, such as on energy. Extremely important, a lot of people actually don't know that the programs are managed by managing authorities, not by us. We don't see the projects, we actually don't know what happens in detail. It's the ministries, the local and regional authorities that select and implement the projects. So this means also that the people you have to contact, to get in touch with, are at local and national level. They manage the funding, not us, the Commission. Now, what is in this policy for the next 7 or 10 years, actually, concerning renewables and smart grids? First, a look backwards, but it's really very useful. The European Court of Auditors just released an audit on how our funding was used in the 2007-13 period. So it's quite an interesting document. There were audits made in a number of member states where the auditors analyzed how the funding was used on renewable energy. The conclusions are rather positive. You can read that projects delivered, which is extremely important, but there was some need for improvement, especially in terms of cost effectiveness. So I would say, all in all, the message there is rather positive, and it shows that using cohesion policy funding for renewable energy can make sense. Now, what do we have in store for the next 7 years? These are the so-called thematic objectives, so the list of 11 priorities from which member states can choose to build on their programs. You can see in red that we have a clear focus on a shift toward a low carbon economy and also on innovation and network infrastructure. And I will now go in the detail of these different possibilities. Extremely important, and this is really a game changer. For the first time in this policy, we have a mandatory ring fencing of the funding to certain sectors. You can see it there. And one of the sectors is low carbon economy. And depending on the region you are in, the member states have to dedicate either 12, 15, or 20% of the funding to energy efficiency or renewables, up to them to choose. It means that all member states, all regions will actually have funding for energy efficiency and renewables, which is really a big change compared to the past. Another kind of soft revolution, I would say, in our perspective is we have for the first time as well so-called ex-ante conditionality. What does it mean? The Commission checks beforehand whether the member states do fulfill a number of criteria before they can get the funding. For instance, there are ex-ante conditionality which are linked to the energy efficiency directives on cogeneration and the renewable energy directives. If member states do not fulfill the criteria, which unfortunately is the case in a number of them, they have to develop action plans. We will not block funding unless there are really very bad cases, because of the course the aim is to help member states to implement solutions, not to block the funding. But in case by end of 2016 they wouldn't fulfill the conditions, then we could block funding. And so this is a major new tool for the Commission to make sure that the enabling conditions, the framework is there, to make sure that if EU public money is used, it's used for good projects. Now, what is the philosophy behind our policy, especially in the area of energy, sustainable energy? One of the key lines is, of course, that our funding, so public funding, complements the private investments. This is extremely important. Even though there will be a lot of funding available, it's a drop in the ocean compared to the needs on the side of renewable or energy efficiency. So we need to make sure that there is a very high leverage effect and that more and more financial instruments are going to be used. And this is now daily discussions, negotiations, sometimes tough, with member states to push where relevant for the setup and the design of financial instruments. Of course, grants do make sense, and a lot of member states will continue to use grants, but we really want to restrict them to cases where there is really a market failure to support innovative technologies. Of course, this is one of the key aim of this policy, is to push innovation, not least in renewable energy sector, and also to go beyond cost optimal investments in the energy efficiency sector. Now, what is the main focus of our policy as regards renewable energy investments? Of course, our policy is very much place-based, so it's a bottom-up approach. We discuss with regions and member states. We see what their issues are, what are their potentials as well. So we do not impose, of course, certain choices, but we discuss to make sure that they can reach the targets, their national targets, and helping to contribute to EU targets. One of the key line and the things we are pushing for is to support decentralized renewable energy production in terms of electricity. Very much heating and cooling, it has been discussed yesterday. It is a key priority, and our funding will be there in a lot of member states to support projects on heating and cooling. We will also see much more integration of energy efficiency and renewable energy in buildings. So we are asking member states that when they address energy efficiency in buildings, they also think about integration of renewable energy sources where this is possible. One of the priority there is especially on demonstration of zero emission buildings or positive energy buildings. Now a word on energy interconnectors and smart grids. This has been one of the key discussion points yesterday, and I changed a bit my PowerPoint yesterday evening to have a word on that. The priority in our policy is really to focus on smart grids at low and medium voltage level. Initially, when the Commission came out with the proposal, major energy infrastructure were not eligible. So we didn't want to fund interconnectors, gas or electricity interconnectors. Why? Because in the previous period, money was available and member states didn't use it. Then in the trilogue discussions, it was added into the regulation, and so now it is eligible, so member states, they can fund with the Cohesion Fund or the European Regional Development Fund, electricity or gas links and interconnectors. We think that it is often not the best possible use of very scarce and limited EU funding. We prefer, because this policy has also an objective in terms of social cohesion, to address, for instance, energy poverty than interconnectors. For interconnectors, there is Connecting Europe Facility, and we think the main aim for the interconnectors, if they are looking for public finance, is through the CEF. Having said that, I think about 6 or 7 member states will use our funding to support interconnectors in gas and electricity. This is now being discussed, but it will be limited to certain specific cases. We have also negotiated with certain member states that if they fail to get the CEF, which as you know is a competitive procedure, they could get our funding later on. But the priority is really to channel the Connecting Europe Facility instrument to this kind of infrastructure. Now, this is, I would say, extremely good news. What is the funding available? You have heard yesterday from my colleague Mary Donnelly, the 38 billion euros. Indeed, this is the, I would say, the latest state of play. As we are negotiating, the figures are changing by the day. But we think that in the whole low carbon economy investments, there will be 38 billion euros. Within the 38 billion, of course, there will be a lot of different things. There will be energy efficiency, renewables, and sustainable urban transport. We don't have details so far. The only thing which I can tell you is that we think between 15 and 18 billion euros will go into energy efficiency, which is a lot, which is much more than in the past period. In the past period, we had about 11 billion in total for RES and energy efficiency. So it's really another landscape. The challenge as well will be enormous because a lot of the member states which now have enormous funding, you see behind me the blue bar, in the past they had not a lot of funds to manage in our remit. So the challenge will be enormous. But I think from the first message here is that this is extremely good news to finance renewables and energy efficiency. Extremely important for us is pushing finance into innovation in renewable energy and making the link with what we have in our policy, which is called smart specialization strategies. So you probably know that there is Horizon 2020, which will finance innovation. What you might not be aware of is that in our policy, there is more funding for innovation than in Horizon 2020, which is often not well used, and so we are also out there to make sure that the innovation potential in our policy will be used. What we are now discussing with member states is the content of their innovation strategies. They have to come up with either national or regional innovation strategies, and our line there is really to emphasize that smart and sustainable are the two sides of the same coin. So where member states are investing in innovation, we also want to see green innovation, clean tech, investments in new materials, in new technologies, new energy technologies, and so on. And we are now having feedbacks from a good number of regions that will be very ambitious in this regard, which is good news as well. What we have really highlighted, and we have some positive feedback, is, for instance, that our funding is used much more for research, development, and innovation in marine energies. We have had some good projects in the past in Spain, in the UK, and other member states. To support second and third generation biofuels, this is something which we have now in a number of programs. Of course, energy storage is one of the big needs, and there are a number of programs which will especially focus our funding on research and innovation in energy storage. Electric mobility as well, so in many member states we will co-fund the deployment of the needed infrastructure. And then I would say on a broader scale, depending on needs and capacities as well, our funding will be used in innovation in solar, biomass, and wind energy. We of course work a lot with DG Research and Energy to make the link with the set plan. If you are really interested, we just published a new guide, which is called Synergies Guide with Horizon 2020, to see how our funding can be combined with Horizon 2020 funding. If you are really interested in smart specialization, there is a lot of material available. Don't hesitate to look at it, because it's really one of the key novelty and the funding stream in the next period. This is available here. Maybe you took it. It's kind of our philosophy, and especially a collection of good practices on what we would like to see in the new programs in terms of innovation and clean technologies, innovation and energy. So this shows that what we are asking for, it's not a revolution. Some member states or regions are actually already doing it, and we want to mainstream this kind of good practices. Quickly, because there was some talk about energy efficiency as well, one of the areas we are going to invest a lot is financing the renovation of buildings. And with DG Energy, we developed this technical guidance, which is extremely well done and which says everything about like cohesion policy funding and renovation of buildings. So this also, I would encourage you to have a look at this document. Quickly to finish, some project examples. First, an extremely good case from Styria, a region in Austria, that developed smart specialization in clean tech. So they really developed a whole work and a cluster of companies and SMEs around innovation in energy and environmental technologies. What is extremely interesting for us in terms of value for money is the impact they reached. So you can see that new jobs were created, profits increased, and extremely interesting, because there is always the talk that innovation doesn't pay back, it pays back. You see that here the share of self-finance of these companies, it grew from close to zero to more than 40% after just a few years. So this shows that public funding can make sense in innovation. There was a lot of criticism yesterday here that innovation policy doesn't work. We know there are a lot of issues, but this work now, which is completely new and which is based on a bottom-up approach, working with local and regional stakeholders, engaging everybody in innovation, is this kind of change which is needed. And some regions have demonstrated that it works. It was mentioned as well that we have some financial instruments in energy efficiency. I just wanted to quickly show you this, how to develop revolving funds for energy efficiency. We have an extremely good case in Estonia. It looks complex. It is a bit complex indeed. The idea is to set up a fund of funds to increase the leverage effect and reach a broader scale in terms of what you can retrofit with our limited funding. So you see here, there was, for instance, only 17 million of ERDF, but then adding money from the CEB, the Development Bank, and Credex, which is a state fund in Estonia, you really have a much bigger power to retrofit buildings in a larger scale. Lithuania had a similar approach. It's called Jessica Fund. This is now running, going on, and it will be expanded. The message here is that even though financial instruments are sometimes complex and difficult to set up, it is something which is already existing and works. For now, we have it essentially in the field of energy efficiency, but we hope to see much more of these instruments also for renewable energy. To conclude, there is funding available, significant funding for renewable energy and sustainable energy, which includes also grids and smart grids. The opportunity for innovation should not be forgotten, so we really hope that all players and actors will seize this opportunity for innovation in energy technologies. Now, what is crucial is that there are a number of challenges. We have good programs, there is funding available, but it doesn't mean that good projects will be implemented. And so my message to all of you today is please get involved, contact your national, regional authorities, any stakeholder involved in energy, because there is really a need to get a broad mobilization around this funding. We know that certain member states, they will have 1, 5, or 10 billion available for sustainable energy. We will have 2, 3 years to get mobilization to make sure that the project pipeline is filled and that the projects are actually implemented. And this is a responsibility for us Commission, but I would say also for the member states and all stakeholders in the member states. I leave it here. If you have any question right now, I'm happy to answer, of course, or then later on, as I said, in the round table, we can go much more in detail into this very interesting topic. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mathieu. Now we will go to Mr. João Mansoneto. He's the CEO of EDP Renewables, and we are very happy to have you here because you can tell us a little bit more about the success stories here in Portugal and why Portugal can now be a leading role for Europe. That's actually one of the reasons why we're here. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much, first place, for having invited me. So I was asked to speak about the Portuguese success story about in terms of renewables. So my intervention will be basically divided into parts. First part, I will speak about the past and the present, and I will give in the second part some views regarding the possible future. So the policy, the progress so far, based on the pillars which were adopted by European Union in 2008, Portugal had a binding objective of having 31% of renewables to reach these objectives. We have in Portugal decided to bet on the more mature technologies. And so basically we had a very old electrical system, and the program was based in basically three pillars. The first one was to replace and change dramatically the thermal fleet. We had decommissioned the fuel plants, and we introduced new CCGTs, gas plants, which practically were at minimal levels. But mainly, the program was based in two issues. One, from one side, Portugal was one of the two countries in Europe, in the European Union, that had not exploited totally the hydro plants. So first objective is to put in value the hydro plants potential that we still had. On the other hand, the wind, as you know, Portugal is a rather windy country, and to put in value also the wind, and trying to increase from less than 1,000 to more than 5,000 megawatts installed. So how did we do it? Portugal invests in terms of all in private investment, 4 gigas in new hydro plants. 50% of them is already made. Part of them are new plants, another part of repowering of plants. In terms, so it was an investment of $5 billion. Always, I was telling everything private investment based in market. In what concerns winds, instead of just having a retail approach, a piecemeal approach, what Portugal decides to have big auctions in which the companies were required not only to build wind farms, but also to create industrial clusters. And so this is what we did, and in that case, we reached the objectives in terms of renewables, and we created two clusters in terms of wind, with factories which produce, with a support, with a foreign investment, which produce basically the whole chain of value. With all this, in this moment, more than 50% on average, because hydro is very volatile, as you know, is produced today by renewables, mainly wind and hydro. And the results in terms of external dependence are important. So with this, we were able to reduce by 10 points the level of external dependence. As you know, in Portugal, the depend of the year, sometimes when it rains or not rains, it fluctuates a lot. But comparing comparable years, we were able to reduce from 85 to 78%, as you can see, the external dependence, which represents also a sharp increase in the CO2 emissions which were avoided. What normally people say, well, this is very nice, but what is the impact in terms of prices? So people now, it's very popular to speak about that renewables tend to increase the price. And let's look at this. On the right side, you have the traditional value, the normal value that the CO2 emissions have been reduced. But I would call you to the right-hand side, which I think it's less orthodox, but totally true, is that although Portugal represents 50% of the power came from renewables, Portugal still have, in terms of industrial consumers, a price from lower than the average. And this means that renewables did not impair the competitiveness of Portuguese industry. But let's go further on this, because this is perhaps the thing that we are, in terms of renewables, very often attacked, that we are very expensive, and I would try to show that this is really not the case. And not the case the way we want. If you want to compare things, you have to compare the things which are comparable. And what the reality shows is that when we compare what is comparable, meaning the total cost of an investment in terms of capacity, what we can see today is that renewable, these numbers are for Europe, for a country like Portugal or Spain, things like that, or German. And what we can see today is that when you consider the full costs of the power, hydro and wind onshore are clear the most less expensive, when considering all the costs, meaning fuel costs, investment costs, O&M costs. And when we compare some, it's very popular to speak about nuclear to be very competitive. Here, I don't have to make any calculations now, because the price of the nuclear is a public one, is the price in which EDF and the UK government made the agreement. It's about £95, which is about 110. And if we make the same calculations for gas or for coal, all of them are much expensive, more expensive than hydro or wind. So why do people say that wind is expensive? Because they are comparing things which are not comparable. The problem here is that in continental Europe, the prices, in the spot prices, are very low because there is overcapacity, because there is economic crisis. And all you have on the bar on the horizontal side, this more or less the 40 euros, which is the price. And so what people look is say, well, wind is very expensive because it receives 65 to 8 euros, and the spot price is 40, so incurs an extra cost of 45. What people don't understand is that the 45 does not compensate investment in any technology at all. It's not the problem of the wind, not the problem of the solar. This is a problem of all the technologies, as you can see, nuclear, coal, gas, all of them cannot survive with this price. So the apparent, so when we compare, if you want to build new capacity, it's very clear that the renewables, matured renewables, are clear, the most competitive, and the apparent overcost comes from the fact that you have today spot prices which don't make viable any technology at all, namely the thermal ones. And that's why the British, which needs power, had to make long-term CFDs with Contract for Difference, with EDF, and they will have to do and have to have capacity payments for gas plants. And that's why if Germany does not want plants to close, they have to pay capacity payments. But that's because you have a market which is not available, not because renewables are expensive. And in fact, this is because Portugal, now let's continue to speak about prices, because I think this is something where we are strongly attacked, and we should be clear, we have the numbers to be able to answer all these misunderstandings, is that when we invest in renewables which are mature, what's happening is what I showed to Portugal. Portugal has the highest level of penetration of renewables. However, the cost, the overcost per unit is lower than the average. Why? Because Portugal, and this is something which is distinctive in Portugal, our investment was made in mature renewables. I think, and this is also a lesson that we should have from the past. It's very fancy to make renewables very not mature, but it's very, if they are not mature, it's expensive. So we have to have a balance between renewables and being green and being competitive. And in the case of Portugal, I think we were successful because we did not take too much enthusiasm with non-mature renewables. We did things. Namely, we are the pioneer in terms of wind floats, wind offshore floating, in terms of we are pioneers on that, but we are speaking about small amounts, which does not burden the wallet of the consumer. And this is the point. So we should promote non-mature renewables, but on R&D basis, on a smaller amount. When we want to go to a full scale, we should think about things which are mature, which today clearly are either where it exists, it was the case of Portugal, and wind globally. One thing, and which is really interesting, is that the more we increase the number of renewables, the amount of renewables, the more the apparent overcost increases. Why? Because the more renewables you put in the market, the lower the price will be. Why? Because you put technology with zero variable costs. And so you have that correlation. And one thing which is not obvious, but it's really interesting, is that people speak, namely in Spain, less in Portugal, but namely in Spain, that renewables, wind, is very expensive. This is really not a very deep analysis, because when we make the analysis, we have to have all the effects. If we simulate the Iberian market, Portugal and Spain, without wind, let's assume we had no wind and the market worked. In that case, the prices would go up by about 18 euros per megawatt hour. That means that the difference between pool price and the total price that Portugal and Spain pay to renewables is less than the savings that renewables, I'm speaking about wind, made to the system if they did not exist, and the difference 2.3 billion. And these are, the number can be 2.3, can be 1.8, can be 3, but the numbers are very clear. If you look to the markets on the day-to-day basis, and if to compare days with wind and days without wind, the prices go easily 20 to 25 euros up. All this story is to say that today the Portugal experience was really very important, in which we were able to change dramatically our metrics in terms of electricity, reducing external dependence and not increasing the price. And the reason is clear, this one. But is it or is not true that the European prices are higher than the US? Yes, it is. But why? It's because of renewables. No, it's not because of renewables. As you may know, we, although being a Portuguese and Spanish-based company, we are our main market, USA, so we know USA market. And in USA, they do promote renewables. They promote renewables, but how? Who pays the difference between the spot markets and the price of the renewables? It's not the consumer, it's the taxpayer. So that's why you don't see it in the electrical bill. So all the support for, it's not only for renewables, for oil, for whatever, goes directly through tax credits to the taxpayer, and not for that. But this is one of the reasons. But the most important reason is not that one. The main reason for the difference between the prices in electricity between Europe and USA comes from one thing which is called shale gas. The price of the gas is 40%, 35% of the price of the gas in USA, of the price of the gas in Europe. It has to do with shale gas, which is a complex issue. But the difference comes from that, not from renewables. The renewables, as I tried to show with an example for US, for Iberian market, but I could do the same example for Germany, and we have done it. We could extract wind from the German metrics, we'll have higher price increase. The difference in prices comes not from renewables, which are competitive, but comes basically from the shale gas issues and the tax, a different way of approaching this. So this is the present and the past, and I would say Portugal is a good experience. I would say, which shows, and this is important in this model when we discuss European Union policy, that it's not only possible, but it's the only way to compatibilize competitiveness with sustainability is through renewables plus, and of course, energy efficiency. What about the future? Let's see. More and more, it's impossible for Portugal to have an energetic policy without European, outside of European policy, and it would not make sense. So I would say that the future for Portugal is going to be more and more much linked with the European Union policy in terms of energy. What we are seeing still today, not everybody thinks the same, but what we are seeing today a lot in terms of European Union thinking, namely in what concerns competition, general DG competition, and is that people say, well, renewables don't need any kind of special support, they should go to the market directly. The only objective that should be set at European level should be the CO2 objective. So it's a very orthodox way of saying the thing, say, with the CO2 objectives and with a free market, everything will go well, and so we don't need to do anything. This is very attractive from the academic point of view, but in my opinion, it does not work. And it does not work, why? Because, as I tried to show you, the more renewables, because we have an excess capacity today in most of European countries, and the more renewables you put in the market, the lower the price will be, the more volatile you have. The situation is that if you have a situation in which you fully believe in the spot market, and if you just have an object of CO2, what would happen is that we would have very low prices, and you won't see any investments in terms of renewables or any other technology. So if we believe and if we try to experiment this model in which no support will have just CO2 and spot markets, my belief is that all the investments in new capacity would be stopped. Would it be totally negative? No, I would say that there will be a consequence. The consequence that will be is that we would see coal being replaced by gas, which will be positive, but I would say that not all the objectives of the European Union will be met. So with this policy, I would expect to see no new material investment in renewables. I would see a replacement of coal by gas. So today we have gas plants stopped and coal plants working will be the opposite, but nothing more. And why? This is basically what I was saying today, what is called normally the energy-only market, so this spot market does not work. Why? Because being the investment so capital-intensive, the investors require stability in terms of returns. So what we need, in my opinion, in this moment, is to have a policy in terms of European Union based in three pillars. One, we should have objectives to 2030, during the next weeks, we expect to have news, but I would say that having objectives of renewables, it's important. If it's our national or European, it is more, we can discuss them, but binding objectives are needed. We need to have objectives in terms of energy efficiency and in terms of CO2, of course. We need to have all of them. But this is one condition, not the only one. The second condition we must have is to have a complete change in the way the market is designed today. As I was telling you, a spot market as it's done does not work. No investments are promoted. And this is so true, what I'm saying is that, is the proof of this, is the country which needs investments, case of UK, how does it work, made contracts for difference. If we look at other countries in the emerging market countries, if Brazil or Mexico or South Africa need investments, how do? They have long-term agreements by auction. And so Europe should move on the same direction. So what we can discuss the details of the model, but I would say that we need to have not the spot, the spot market is good in terms of fine-tuning, but to have new investment, we need to have long-term contracts predefined. And this is something which is very important. Second point, we know we are pro-renewables. We are, of course, I'm CEO of a renewables company, a group which anticipated the market in terms of renewable, but we should be intelligent enough to understand that we need also thermal capacity. We don't want thermal plants to be broken because the system needs them as backup. So having capacity markets are needed. And sometimes people discuss between gas from one side, renewables from the other side. I think this is a mistake. A mistake that industry have been incurring systematically. We need to have a global integrated metrics, and it requires that besides new investment renewables, we need to create conditions that on a market basis, those plants of coal, mainly of gas, which are backup exists. And we need to have, of course, an ETS which works. Today it does not work. And I think the proposals that the Commission made are sensible, that we cannot have a system as we had in which we have a supply which is fixed, a supply of CO2, and the demand floats. So what we have to have here is something which is very similar to what we have in the banking system. The central banks, what they do is manage the liquidity. And this is what we need here. And so the proposals are sensible. And on the other hand, another pillar of the change of the market is that retroactive changes cannot happen. It's not possible. If Europe wants to be a state of a region of total law, it's not acceptable that one or two countries change completely the law without the firm condemnation from European Union. This is not reasonable. And Portugal, in that case, was a very good example. But like Portugal, other countries like France or like Italy, or like Poland, they respected the things. What is not acceptable is that one or two countries change the rules without being firmly condemned by the European Union. This is not reasonable. One of the things why USA is our main market is because just regulatory stability is a must. Nobody thinks in that country has lots of problems in a difficult market, but changing the law is completely out of question. So, market design is very important. So, objectives, market design, third pillar should be an increase in interconnections. In terms of interconnection is very important for that we have a common market in terms of energy, and this is not just a word. For that we can have each country specialized in areas in which they have specific advantages. Portugal and Spain have strong ability to pursue strong wind resources. Not only wind resources in absolute term, we also have many areas of the countries which are, like it or not, underpopulated, so it's easier to build with very big places. So I would say interconnections, market redesign, and objectives for free things, CO2, renewables, and energy efficiency are a must. I've been speaking a lot regarding, I'm not going to go to details, so I speak a lot about mature technologies. I would like to give also a word about less mature technologies. And I would speak about three blocks. One is one thing which is very important, more and more important, which is decentralized PV, the PV which people put at their homes and the roofs of their houses. This is more and more competitive and so should be promoted. Here, what we have to have in mind, again, we have to be always very clear in the objective, is that these PVs also need backup from the grid. So we have to be careful in the not in the beginning. The beginning will be, in my opinion, not necessary. But when these decentralized PV begin to have a certain size, should begin paying the backup costs of the network in order to avoid unsustainable synergy. In Portugal, for instance, we just approved the law of self-consumption, which can promote the decentralized PV. on a very sound basis, but has also said there that when the number of installations reach a certain amount, certain payment to the grid must be done. And this is sensible again. In this area, you have to be modern, aggressive, but always sensible. Second point, the less mature commercial but less mature, like centralized PV and offshore wind, I think that they should be promoted. They are important to create industrial clusters. We cannot forget that Europe is still the European companies are still the market leaders in terms of onshore. Companies like Vestas or Gamesa are European countries, companies which are market leaders, Alstom, which are important as market leaders. We should try to also to have these market leaders, market important companies here, and for that makes sense to have clusters, but again, we have to be moderate in terms of the amounts that we incentivize. For instance, the example of France in terms of the offshore, it's a good example. They made five bids. The total amount of the offshore could be about 1% of the tariff, so nothing special. We, in fact, we won two of them together with Gaz France, so we know it well. But case of France, it's a friendly case of offshore, it's something which could be an example. It was well designed, and moderate amounts make sense. And finally, there are others which are much more immature yet, and here those should be done and should be promoted on an R&D basis. And here, I speak by personal experience, I think European Union is very important. So European Union has, for instance, in our case, we are going to develop a second phase of the offshore, floating offshore wind that I spoke before. Now, as 2017, we are being supported by NER 300, and those funds work. What sometimes does not work at European level are the more conventional institutions. The European Investment Bank perhaps does not always develops the role it should. So we have, in terms of Europe, I'm not an expert in this area, but my feeling is that, and my is that impression is that we are good in terms of creating innovative things, which is good, but sometimes the basic, the plain vanilla funding is less good than it should be. What about Portugal? Let's see. About Portugal, in terms of the future, of course, Portugal should engage itself, namely, in what concerns the economic policy, as you referred before. So having objectives in renewables, having the interconnection, having a market design, this is crucial for Portugal. This is the most important. Besides that, we have objectives also in terms of renewables, so to conclude the investments in terms of the hydro, which is being done, to put in value the wind, which was authorized but not yet built, which are big amounts and should be done. We should do better in terms of transportation, and the electrical vehicle should be revived. So it was a bit asleep for a few years, and I would say have good conditions. Again, it's a way of creating demand for electricity and reducing the dependence on oil. And today, in Portugal, 37% of final consumption of energy is transport, only 25% electricity. So we're great in electricity, but not too much in terms of transportation. And finally, in terms of energy efficiency, it's an area in which we should grow. Smart grids is crucial. Portugal was, a few years ago, in the front runner of this. We made a big pilot in the south of the country, but we are now a bit behind, but we have possibility to overcome, but this is a fact, it should go ahead. And finally, we have a green fiscal reform to be put in place. But frankly, and finally, the objective that our minister has referred several times, which is what the third pillar I referred before, which fight for interconnections. Does not make sense that Portugal and Spain are practically an island in terms of from Europe, either in terms of electricity and in terms of gas. As you may know, I don't know if it was referred yesterday, but most of the gas terminals, of import terminals, are in Iberica Peninsula, and the ability to export to France is minimum. And it's complete. And in France also, France have also two markets between the south and the north. So I would say interconnection is critical in electricity, yes, but also in gas. So to conclude, I think that Portugal was a very, very good example in terms of being able to show that we can change the metrics in less than 10 years without increasing the prices, because we were sensible and we invested in what was mature. It's an example. The future should be designed in terms of a change of European Union adjustment, thinking on 2020 and 30, and with, in my opinion, three pillars, which means objectives for renewables, CO2 and energy efficiency, change of market design, and investment in interconnection. Thank you very much.
So, thanks, Mr. Manzoneto. Are there already questions? We have 10 minutes to have questions to Mr. Manzoneto. Yes, there's one.
Thank you. Thank you for very good presentations for all panelists. I'm Alexander Devianovich, and I'm coming from Montenegro. And I noticed in the end of the presentation of Mr. Neto, some term called green fiscal reform. Can you explain something more about what does mean green fiscal reform? Is it some new taxes or some adaptation of existing taxes? Because in Montenegro we are in the middle of adaptation of new energy efficiency laws, and we have to know what is a good practice in Europe and in Portugal according to the fiscal reform, because a law about energy efficiency in Montenegro does not predict any fiscal incentives for energy efficiency. Thank you.
Oh, sorry, thank you very much. So thank you very much. So the fiscal reform is a project of law which is being discussed today in Portugal. The idea is not to increase the taxes. We have very high taxes in Portugal. The idea is to create tax in areas which are more which create pollution or includes the issue CO2, and to balance this, to reduce the tax over income, which in Portugal is very strong. The measures did not include very much electricity. Why? Because electricity, as we are in the ETS market, to tax electricity will be a double taxation. So if I had to tax on tax, it will be too high. So in terms of CO2, so it does not impact importantly the electricity, with, but basically industries which generate pollution at high levels on one side. On the other hand side, tax the some transports, namely private cars, and creates incentives to make fuel switches in terms of transportation, either to electrical one or to gas, because even gas is less. So, it's the fiscal reform, to summarize, does not impact dramatically electricity, because electricity had the CO2 scheme, but basically transportation and some traditional uses of people, like, for instance, plastic bags and small things in which people should begin to pay 1 to 2 cents, all this amount should be utilized to reduce the income taxes in Portugal, namely on private people, which very high.
Claude?
Thank you, Mr. Nieto. I think that was, at least for me, one of the best speeches I have heard the last 10 or 15 years on renewables and the interaction with the market costs. That was clear, and I think we should turn you around in Europe, organize a tour, Nieto tour. A bit like Mick Jagger or whatever, to explain people what's reality. And what gets for me more and more clear is that these PV bubbles, they are really hurting us hard, because with the PV bubbles, the image of renewables has become a disastrous image. And even so, that Germany is in volume the country which, and also because it's the biggest elephant in the room, it's a good showcase, but it's a disastrous showcase because they didn't have their PV under control. I have one question. I was with the CEO of a major power company some days ago, and he talked me also on this long-term power purchase agreements in Chile, in Mexico. What I do not yet see is how can I see the so it's a bit like the contracts for difference in UK, but the same CEO said to me, we will do long-term power purchase agreements, but no targets anymore, no support anymore. So, but then we are in a market. You said ETS will not drive investments. So if we don't have a strong renewable target, where do we go? And I think what will happen is a slowdown of the speed of renewable investments. Do you share that? And my second question, I have the impression that we have today a strong governance. The problem is that Commissioner Oettinger, he didn't do his job in Spain. Why did Commission accept that the Spanish government could do a disaster, and a disaster not only for Europe. Investors outside Europe, they consider now Europe to be a disaster for renewable investments because the Spanish government has retroactively changed. It has a much bigger impact than just Spain, and the Commission didn't do its work because this, what they did to the Spanish, is not in the spirit of the renewable energy law. But now, with this very loose 27%, which is a very low ambition, plus no governance behind. My analysis is that now we are in a system where we are back, everybody speaks of the energy union, and in the same moment we destroy the governance and the convergence and the top-down coordination of Europe. Do you share this, or what's your feeling on what's going on, and what would be one or two ideas which you could help us to structure this European debate?
Let's see. So, frankly, firstly, thank for comparing me with Mick Jagger, but it's completely not deserved, really. It's a different league. So, but nevertheless, I agree with you that that's why I tried to stress that we are in favor, all of us which are here are in favor of renewables, but we must be sensible. And having a country promoting immature technologies on a gross, on a very widespread basis, as did Germany, as did Spain, which we always with solar, this is a mistake. So we, as green supporters, we always should look at the economic side and say, can the country pay for this? And I would say that this is our, all of us can participate, we should always stop, or try to stop, too much enthusiasm and always look to the economics. And what happened in Spain also has this excuse, if you want, is that because they were too much in terms of the bubble. So we should look always to competitive technologies. So regarding the PPAs, I would say, my view is that the reason why people invest in Mexico or South Africa or USA is the same as people invest or not invest in Europe. So if we don't create a systems of auction in Europe with long-term PPAs, power purchase agreement, or CFD, because CFD and PPAs is the same thing. It's a question of being more elegant and it's more sophisticated. There are people who say don't like PPAs but like CFD. 90% the same. So, but frankly, we need to have this because nobody. Let's see, if I invest to build 1 megawatt in onshore is 1.5 million euros. If it's offshore, it's 4 million euros. So nobody is going to invest all this amount without having a certainty about the income in the future. This is not market. It is because we compete ex ante, not ex post. So I would say that the same receipts that justify investments abroad, in Mexico, Brazil, and whatever, and USA, as we are also, are the same which are required in Europe. And that's why, in case of France, the auction was, in terms of CFDs, the auctions were a success. Another country, Italy, which is a good example. Italy had 500 megawatts per annum of winds, no more, no less, competition. Those who offer less are awarded. And in Italy, people are investing there. So where don't they invest in this moment is Romania, because they are changing things and things like that. And so we need to have, so there is, if people who say, well, in Europe we don't need this, but we need outside, meaning they are not interested in investment in Europe, clearly. If you want to have investments in Europe, we need to have PPAs. To be always fair and sensible, today in Europe, we don't need today, in most of the places, a lot of renewables, but we should keep the machine rolling. We should keep a certain level of investment in renewables, as the Italians are doing. So we, and for instance, the model in Germany, to have a band cannot be lower than that, the new one, lower than that, then higher than that, makes sense. So because the band, because it's limiting the amount. So what I would recommend in Europe is that we should continue to have objectives of renewables, binding objectives, not very big in this moment because it is an overcapacity, but should be there. Because if they are not, we can say, well, if they are not there, no problem, we have overcapacity, no problem. Well, of course, we have two problems. One is because if you don't have renewables, we import more gas or import more coal. On the other side, which is very important, if we are for 5 or 7 years without investment in renewables in Europe, what would happen is that the factories that we have in Europe will go away. Even of Portuguese, or even of European companies. Let's see, if I'm Vestas, and if I don't have demand of wind in Europe, why? And Vestas has, fortunately, plants in all the way, everywhere in the USA, in Brazil. So, would they be having the factories working in Europe to export to Brazil? Would not make sense. We didn't export that by plane, as you understand. So, huge equipment. So, if we stop completely the investment in renewables in Europe in the next 5 to 7 years, we would lose at least the jobs and the factories there, besides not having that. So my recommendation would be clearly to keep at the more moderate amounts the investments in renewables through an auction system, which is market run. Who is more competitive wins, who is more expensive loses. And this is the only way of promoting renewables. And this is, again, if the CEO told you that he's investing in abroad as we are with PPAs, it's the same condition to invest in Europe. And we need it if we don't want to incur the risk of losing these investments. Regarding the fact that the Europe was very passive in what concerns the Spanish regulation, this is what I did not want to put the name of the country, but of course it's public information. Europe should have, European Union should, I'm not saying it was Mr. X, it was Mr. X, but much more people. It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable that Europe must distinguish itself by several reasons, because it's green, because it respects human rights, but and should be respect the law. It's not acceptable that one country does not respect the law. And what can we do? Nothing. And this is accept. And I shall agree with you, but I would not say it's the name of a person. I would say it's an opinion. I would say, in terms of competition, there are lots of people who, in DG competition, which thought it was very good, because people were earning too much money. Making comparison, for instance, comparing the investments today with the costs today, with the tariff of the previous past with the costs today, things like that. But it's like that. So, by frankly, I'm not pessimistic about that. I would say that the way we defend the objectives for 2030 is crucial. I think we need to have objectives for renewables. The question here is that we are placing is that a global objective in terms of international enough, or should we have binding? Let's see, binding, national binding. I would say national binding will be safer. But you can ask, can we live with the European binding? We can. Provided two things are done. One is that European Commission has the power to oblige the countries that don't comply with the objectives to act. has the power and utilizes the power. And this example of what happened in Spain is not a very good pre-announcement, but I don't want to judge anybody by intentions. But nevertheless, so theoretically could work on the international basis. If European Union had the power and wanted to act against the power, and acting quickly, not 10 years later. Second, it's important that gradually, but we move to interconnection, because to have global objectives makes theoretical sense if we have good interconnections. Because I see the logical of having global one is say, well, if Portugal has much better conditions for wind or for sun than Germany, why am I developing in Germany, not in Portugal? Speed up. Oh, sorry. And so we need both conditions to be done. Yeah. So we need to have interconnections. Otherwise, it does not work because Portugal could not export to Germany. Sorry.
I'm very sorry. We have to speed up. We have to go to the next presentation now. Then in the end, we will see if we have a few minutes to round up things for the three speakers. But I would like to invite Jan Benjamin Spitzli now. Great debates. We have lots of time still to discuss on that. But we have to go now to a judgment on where we are today and what we project will happen in 2020, if we are on track or not. So Jan Benjamin Spitzli from Eclarion, also partner of our Keep on Track project, will give us a little input on that.
Thank you very much. Indeed, I will try to give you a picture of where we are on our way to... That's a bit too small, actually. Probably. Go to the full screen.
Yeah.
And can you click on the house once? No.
There's a little house right there.
Okay, now it's good.
Up there. It's good?
Yeah. I will give you a bit of an overview on where we are on our way towards the 2020 targets and probably some aspects that we should consider if we want to be successful. As Jan has correctly said, results that you see in this presentation are taken from the Keep on Track project, a project of 15 consortium members under the leadership of Euphorus, we as Eclarion being responsible for the coordination of research analysis, and then we do a large share of the research ourselves too. Before I will enter into the content as such, probably first some words on the picture and why we chose this picture. We speak always of being on track, off track, and it assumes a bit, it's a railway track towards 2020, and then eventually we reach a 2020 station, and all will be good. And this is probably not the case, but it's more a mountain that we are actually looking at. And that's what we try to visualize with this picture. So what you have, if you want to climb a mountain, you obviously have a base camp, being here the lowest box, and then you start walking up the hill or the mountain, as you wish to call it. And the second box is probably where we are today. So we have done a bit, but there's still a lot of things ahead to reach Mount 2020. And then obviously there are risks, and we visualize them here as gaps or troughs or whatever you would like to call them. And then obviously there are also aspects you want to consider to reach the final element of the mountain. And we will also look at some aspects once you reach the mountain, how to progress. So that's probably some of the pictures that we would like to create when we look at the efforts that we have to do towards 2020. The base camp, and you would know this, so I don't have to enter into large details, are the 2020 targets as they have been enacted through the climate and energy package in 2009. So you know all this 20% reduction, la la la. And this is actually the starting point, what we're looking at. But I think much more interesting is actually what has been achieved so far. And then from today's perspective, what is the estimation for 2020 and where will we end up? 2012, this is the map as it stands in terms of deviation analysis here done through our partner Fraunhofer ESI. Analysis of 2012 targets, and you see that the majority of member states is actually green. Green meaning here that they have reached the individual and REAP targets for 2012 as well as the biannual directive target 2011-2012. Then you see some countries being yellow, orange, as you would like to call it, and these countries have not achieved the NREAP target, but they have achieved the biannual target as defined in the RES directive. And then there are two targets two countries that are colored red, they have neither achieved the NREAP target, nor did they achieve the biannual target of the REST directive. So you see here the two countries being red, it's the Netherlands and France. And I think if you look at the map of today, it looks quite promising. We are in the majority on track, so this is actually a good signal, yet do not forget where we are on the mountain. There is a lot of work ahead, and I think the picture as it stands today is true, but it's also only an intermediate picture. So probably looking at 2020, and here picture changes quite decisively. This is a forecast basically based on a green X scenario done by the Technical University of Vienna. If we look out of a perspective of, it was last year, this year, we have to say, so these calculations have been done at the spring of this year. If we look at these calculations, 14 countries out of the 28, 27 are off track. Additional four countries, we at least have strong doubts if they will reach the target. And only nine countries we see as being on track. They will achieve the target, or respectively, they have achieved these targets already. So I don't want to discourage anyone with this picture, and I think this is a very important information, because there is a time frame now left until 2020 where member states can act and can take measures. And I will come also in a bit also to Portugal, because Portugal probably is one of the most promising candidates that really act on issues and try to solve issues. And I think we will see probably for the next analysis of that is now upcoming that Portugal will be differently colored as it is here. But I'm just saying you need also this courage of a country to take the necessary measures now, because measures that you take now take at least 2 to 3 years to be effective and to play a role. So I mean, seeing that we have 5 years left, you better act quickly. Seeing this picture, I think it's also important to ask, what is the gap? So what are existing barriers? Why do member states do not achieve the targets? And this is where we are quite active in the consortium, analyzing this. And obviously, discussing with you individual barriers would exceed by far any time frame that I was given from you for this presentation. But what we did here is what we call a barrier wall. So a barrier wall, just giving you some key words on what are the dominant barriers of today. The bigger the word, obviously the more bold, and that's it. And I have to say, traditionally we looked at issues of the administrative process. So it was really a long time about complexity, costs, length of the process, which is really a crucial factor if you want to develop installations. So that's it. But since 2 years, we detect that any other barrier is covered by one issue, and that's what we call the framework. So what do we mean by framework? From the ground, we do get the signals that there is a strong problem with the existence and the reliability of support schemes and the general REST strategy. So people are really struggling. They are confronted with retroactive, retrospective changes, as you wish to call it. They are confronted with stop-and-go policies. They do not know if what they see today as framework is existing tomorrow. And this will stop any activity. Your investor will not go if he's not sure that the framework you provided is also true tomorrow. And with this element, any other problem that we see, and that is even more important because we should discuss process, we should discuss how you implement projects, is just not important anymore. It's just off the record, and that's wrong. It's really wrong. So we have to work on this one really dominant issue. We have to create a stable framework that provides an environment where you want to invest, where you want to develop these projects. Now, not only saying what are the barriers, but what is also necessary in a short term, so really 2020 horizon, what should we do to get back on track? And then again, I mean, I cannot stress it enough, but it's you have to ensure that there's a predictable and stable legislative framework, and you have to refrain from any retroactive changes. I mean, we heard this also from Mr. Nieto, and I can just also obviously underline this. The Spanish case had demonstrated how you can kill your market overnight with such a decision, and you will never get back on track once you did this. So we have to refrain from these measures. Secondly, there is a traditional dominant focus on RES-E, and I think to a certain degree it's also understandable. But if you see the national action plans, there is also really ambitious targets for the heating and cooling sector, as well as for the transport sector. And these two, they also flag that the dominant issue is the framework, but they are even more dependent on a support framework because they are less mature in their technologies. So we have to refocus our policies also to these two sectors to get something out of them for the 2020 targets. And then the state aid guidelines. The state aid guidelines, as they are today, we plead for reform because they are too narrow. They limit the potential of member states. It has been proven before that the individual support approach of member states is also able to account for the individual circumstances of these states and with this play its role. But now with the state aid guidelines as they are today, they are much too narrow to enable the full potential of the member states. So here really a revision is required. And then obviously, last but not least, we have to retain the focus on the actual administrative barriers in the thing, which are now covered by other issues. But they are the ones that are more important for developers and for investors, and we have to see that there is a focus. Now, seeing the current discussions, you bit have the impression ambitions do stop in 2020. And I'm a bit surprised, to be honest. And that's actually why I can only say we do need an ambitious binding target for 2030. And just to be frank, 27% is everything but ambitious. So, I mean, at least 30% would be something. I would say ambitious is probably even more than that 35 plus that we would call. And then I know that a lot of people might say now, yeah, now he's coming with the national binding target. Yes, I am, actually. Why am I doing this? Because seeing the picture that I showed you for 2020 and seeing that 14 countries are off track, though they do have a binding target, and they might see consequence if they do not realize these targets, we won't get nowhere without a national binding target. And so I think there is still some room, and we have to see if ambitions can be raised to realize such a binding target. Before I close, I would like to address, if you allow, the Portuguese government and also the MEPs directly, because I would like to congratulate, actually, really, for your visionary approach that you have taken on renewables. I think you have shown that even under very hard economic crisis conditions, you have taken this visionary approach to say we bet on renewables. I think especially the agreement that you have concluded in the wind sector between the government and the industry can be really a role model for other countries. You don't have to revert automatically to the fossil-based sources, but you can see if you can find arrangements within your possibilities. I mean, I'm not saying that the agreement is something that everybody is pleased of, but at least it provides a framework, forward-looking framework, in which you can realize renewables. And I can really just say thank you very much for that. Thank you for this actions that you have taken. And thank you very much for your attention.
So thanks a lot, Jan Benjamin. I would say we're over time, but if there's burning questions from members of parliament, I would take them here before we go into the World Cafe. There are no questions. If not, there will be room later on during the World Cafe with the speakers to continue debates a lot. So, which means we will have now a very, very short coffee break, and then this is now the last moment that we are together in here. We will move to another room, and we will have a so-called World Cafe. This is a more interactive format. It's with five tables, with five chairs, and experts on the table. And table one will be on renewables electricity, market-driven renewables. The second one will be RES heating and cooling, a new strategy for the sleeping giant, very interesting. Renewables in transport, bundling e-mobility with renewables. And then we'll have Mathieu Fichter, so there's lots of answers here waiting for you on structural funds and regional deployment. And Jan Benjamin will be there as well to go more into details with you. So I would like to thank you for the moment. We have a short break, and see you then in the other room. And at 1 o'clock, we will have lunch downstairs in the courtyard under the sun. And as you all know, I hope everybody's joining us this afternoon for the fantastic trip to Sintra. And there's more surprises coming up, I can only promise you. So, let's go.